It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Ernest Moniz. Moniz is currently chief executive officer and co-chair of the board of the directors of what is called the Nuclear Threat Initiative. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization founded by former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn and philanthropist Ted Turner. Its work focuses on preventing catastrophic attacks and accidents with weapons of mass destruction and disruption, be they nuclear, biological, radiological, chemical, or cyber. Moniz served in the Obama administration as U.S. Secretary of Energy. That was from 2013 to 2017. And we're taking the opportunity to talk with him while he's in Iowa, working with the State Public Policy Group in Des Moines, also speaking before the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. Secretary Moniz, thank you for coming into our studio. What a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ben.
Tell us more about why you're in Iowa, please.
I'm here because we are trying to raise awareness on some issues that we think deserve much more public discussion. Of course, our perspective is that Iowa is well known to have a very strong voice in delving into important issues, particularly in the political seasons, and frankly, helping shape the discussion. Just to make it very clear, as you said, we are nonpartisan. We are not here to certainly support any candidate or any party. It's really about getting some issues around nuclear security, the risks that we face as a society, the opportunity to minimize, decrease those risks that we'd like to see as a have a more prominent place in the political debate. I might just add, if I may, that 3.5 years ago, in May of 2016, I was at Iowa State to give the commencement speech and receive an honorary doctorate. So I consider myself an honorary cyclone. And
congratulations.
Thank you. And I spoke about the perhaps appropriately then the risks of climate change and solutions around innovative clean energy. And of course, Iowa knows about wind in particular extremely well. But there's a case where what we have seen is a major evolution where the climate debate has a much more prominent place in our public discourse and in this political season, if you like, and we hope all the way through the general election and beyond. So the hope here is that we can, in a similar way, maybe help stimulate more discussion on these very serious issues of nuclear risk.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about it, because as you absolutely identify, I am a Cold War baby, you as well, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. We grew up in an era when we were, well, facing obliteration, and we were reminded of it every week in the news and with the standoff between the U.S. and the USSR during the Cold War. So what are the threats now? What are the greatest nuclear-related threats?
So you raise a very important point that during the Cold War, these were, it wasn't always pleasant, I might add, but certainly we were all aware of the risks involved. And I might say in that period, let's say the 1980s, President Reagan and Secretary of State Shultz and others were very, very actively involved with the Soviet Union in arms control, in risk reduction. Now let's look at things today. We're 30 years past the Cold War, but unfortunately, we remain in postures that are too reminiscent of the Cold War posture. That is, the United States and Russia now have over 90% of the nuclear weapons. We have a very large number of those weapons on what's called prompt launch, so that in the event of a notice to the President of the United States or the President of Russia that the country is under attack, there's the idea that one can start shooting off nuclear missiles within minutes. But now we're doing that now in a situation in which the relationship between the United States and Russia, first of all, is particularly dysfunctional. There's no trust. We do not really have the kind of dialogue that we had even in the Cold War. For example, we had very, very active military-to-military discussions that were about managing a crisis and making sure mistakes were not made. Those interactions are not happening now. We used to have very active ongoing diplomacy on arms control. Well, we're going the other way on that. It started early in this century when ballistic missile treaty was we pulled out of we now recently pulled out of the what's called the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, and right now there's in the balance the last major arms control agreement called New START that both caps the size of the U.S. and Russian strategic forces, but maybe even more importantly, has elements of transparency and verification. If we lose this, and it's right now up for renewal, if we lose this, we will have lost the entire architecture. We will have lost all the ability to see what's going on the other side. Mm-hmm. And this is the same time that not only do we have this situation, which, by the way, we understand is rooted in some very real and difficult issues that we must continue to address, like the Ukraine situation, like the issue of Russian meddling in our elections. But our position is, look, in the Cold War, we also had very, very difficult issues going on. It never stopped us from taking our eyes off the ball of the existential threats that we had a responsibility to our own people, to each other, and to the world to manage for lowering those risks. And now there's a whole new set of risks, which arises from evolving technology. For example, in the Cold War, one didn't have the risk of cyber attacks on the command and control system. One didn't have the situation where artificial intelligence may increasingly be creeping in to the decision-making process of the use or non-use of these weapons. We didn't have the new developments of what are called hypersonic systems for delivering nuclear weapons that not only travel 10 or even 20 times the speed of light, but also are maneuverable to make sure they can't be shot down. So there are so many of these issues that we say that the risk of a nuclear weapon being used is actually probably higher today than any time since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and yet the political discourse is frankly pretty much asleep on these issues. Mm-hmm. And now is the time to get those back into public discourse, get Congress involved. And as I said earlier, Iowa plays a very special role in helping shaping the debate. And we hope that Iowa can help do that at this time on these issues.
Secretary Moniz, I guess you and your organization, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, have asked the question, why? Why is this discussion asleep, as you say?
Well, I think that part of it is what you hinted at earlier, that when the Cold War ended, I think a lot of us let out a kind of a collective sigh of relief and thought that these issues were behind us, the nuclear risks. There's a wonderful book written by a tremendous patriot, former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, who talks about how he started out as essentially a Cold Warrior, started out as an analyst in the Cuban Missile Crisis, went through the whole Cold War buildup, and then when he became, in the Obama administration, first deputy and then Secretary of Defense, he thought that his life would be fulfilled in the sense now of being able to dismantle that entire infrastructure. And now he is saying, boy, was that wrong. Unfortunately, we have to again look at getting into a more stable situation with regard to these weapons. Furthermore, You are apparently more than 30 years old in saying that you were born in the Cold War.
Correct.
but we are 30 years past the Cold War, and that means that we do have a whole new generation that has never really had to think about these questions. So I think we need a lot of public education. I want to emphasize, we're not talking about trying to, you know, stoke fears. What we want to do is to stimulate action that can, in fact, lead us, hopefully, eventually to a world where these risks are eliminated. But step by step, make sure we are heading towards a more stable, a lower risk situation, and not one that could lead probably by accident, by mistake, by having false information into the system, could lead to a nuclear exchange that, of course, would be absolutely catastrophic.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour is Ernest Moniz, former U.S. Secretary of Energy under the Obama administration, currently Chief Executive Officer of what is called the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization focusing on preventing catastrophic attacks, accidents with these weapons of mass destruction. You're a nonprofit. You had this nonprofit organization, nonpartisan. We are less than 2 months away from caucus day here in Iowa. That's also, in a roundabout way, that's the way why you're here in Iowa to bring up these issues. In what ways do you see candidates discussing these specific concerns? Are they? I know you want to remain nonpartisan, but are some of them better at it than others? Are some of them bringing it up as a matter of course?
Well, frankly, we hear virtually no discussion of these issues, and we believe it's, by the way, it's obviously here in Iowa leading up to the caucuses, particularly important. But I have to say, I mean, we obviously hope that these issues can be raised and addressed by all candidates, both parties, all the way up to the general election in November and then beyond. But basically, as I said earlier, while we are seeing a major change in another kind of existential threat, the questions of climate change, elevated dramatically mm-hmm. in the conversation compared to the past, we certainly don't see that right now on these weapons of mass destruction issues. That's what I hope I can contribute in a little way, at least today here, to bring it to the attention of Iowans and to see the public raise these issues in the context of our coming elections, because in the end, it without some political accountability to the public, it's very difficult for any issue to get into the foreground of the discussion.
Mm-hmm. You recently wrote a paper titled Nuclear Nonproliferation: Steps for the 21st Century, in which you outlined several, in your words, technical and policy approaches to mitigating proliferation concerns in the years and decades ahead. You address four categories: detection, prevention, rollback, and subnational risks. Remind us, in this year, at the end of 2019, who has nukes? Which actors have nukes? And is that number expanding?
Well, first of all, in terms of nuclear weapons, of course, they are the original so-called P5, United States, the Soviet Union then and now Russia, then China, the United Kingdom and France. Those are the P5. But of course, we've seen India and Pakistan develop nuclear weapons in what is obviously a very tense military situation between them. A good example of where, again, an accident as well could lead to an escalatory exchange, which would be disastrous. We have North Korea, obviously, and we have real issues in terms of how are we, the United States, working with other countries in the region, our allies for sure, South Korea and Japan, how are we going to denuclearize there? Another very, very risky situation. Of course, there are, it's not confirmed by Israel, but there is a wide expectation, of course, that Israel also has an arsenal. So that's on the countries with nuclear weapons. I do want to make clear that the Iran situation is one where we are very, very confident that certainly Iran does not have today any nuclear weapon. I might note that we have had some success in this. For example, when the Soviet Union broke up, there were nuclear weapons in Kazakhstan, in Ukraine, and in Belarus, they all voluntarily gave up those nuclear arsenals. The weapons were returned to Russia, which was a step at least towards stability. We've had others give up some nuclear weapons programs. And also, very importantly, it's not only about the weapons. The nuclear materials, which are called high-enriched uranium or plutonium, are the hardest part of being able to put together a nuclear explosive. And we have made progress. Roughly half of the countries that had high-enriched uranium have now eliminated that, and that's more than 20 countries, have eliminated their stocks of high-enriched uranium just in this century. So there is some progress, but a lot of risks. And in particular right now, one area, geographical area, considered to be at risk is in the Middle East, in the Gulf region. That's one reason why the Iran deal was so important in terms of providing not only constraints on Iran, but the verification measures that would be needed. And others in the region, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, at the leadership level, have made some statements that were worrying in terms of moving towards nuclear weapons. We certainly hope that won't happen, and our part of our job, including at NTI, is to help make sure it doesn't happen, and that the paper that you described was exactly how do we make sure there is no further spread of nuclear weapons so that we can eventually step by step go down the road towards eliminating this as a risk to our civilization.
Mm-hmm. Secretary Moniz, you have the ears of many caucus goers. I wonder if you can arm, so to speak, our listeners with questions they might ask candidates. What is the question you would put to a candidate to sort of test that candidate's mettle in this area?
Well, I think the fundamental issues, in some sense, are how are we going to restore and build the kind of processes that we need to make sure that we are deliberate in addressing the question of how we position our nuclear weapons and how we provide risk management, risk reduction. That inherently involves, number one, how will we improve in this domain our relationships with Russia for arms control. For example, a very specific question would be the position of candidates on the New START treaty, which is as I said earlier, it's the last remaining major arms control agreement that we have. It is up for renewal in 2021. This is an absolutely critical issue going forward. That's one example. How would the candidates manage the North Korea situation? Very, very important question. How would the candidates address the non-proliferation questions to what you just raised earlier to make sure that we don't have other countries coming in, particularly in the Middle East? So there's a whole list of questions, any of which could lead to a very, very rich discussion, I think, with the candidates. And frankly, I don't see these being addressed in any substantive way.
Mm-hmm. As we mentioned, you, of course, served in the Obama administration, the current administration rolling back many, many things in the Obama administration, including its approach to Iran, a much different approach to North Korea in regards to its nuclear weapons. What's your evaluation of the Trump administration's efforts towards nonproliferation. Have Donald Trump's actions made us more or less safe in this regard?
Well, again, in my visit here to the state, I don't want to get involved in evaluating specific positions in terms of the election. Now, in terms of where we've been going in these last years, it certainly is a mixed bag. For example, with North Korea, I and we believe that we really need to address their denuclearization, and so opening up a dialogue is a very good thing. However, the dialogue is only meaningful if it has a structured set of negotiations that in the long term, this is not for a quick fix. This is in the long term, how will we go step by step towards eliminating nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula. Mm-hmm. In the Middle East, where there are, of course, so many problems, we would note that, again, just as if I go back again to the 1980s and the Reagan administration, we had so many problems with the Soviet Union, but it didn't prevent a focus on the existential threat of nuclear weapons. Similarly, in the Middle East, it would be a disaster if the Middle East became nuclear armed, and so. In the Iran situation, a very, very essential part of the agreement that that they were operating under was that they had absolutely unique and very, very tough verification requirements to make sure they had no nuclear weapon. Well, we're going to have to find a way to getting back to having the kind of confidence that we need and that others in that region need to make sure that we don't see a spread of nuclear weapons. So those are the kinds of issues mm-hmm. that I think are there and where we need to up our game, frankly, in addressing those risks.
Mm-hmm. Your organization trying to prevent any use of nuclear weapons, of course, but what would you say is the most likely scenario for a nuclear weapon being used again on this planet?
Well, we think that the scenario that continues to guide much of our posture, roughly speaking, let's call it, the nuclear Pearl Harbor scenario during the Cold War, which called for kind of speed of response. It led to our vesting full authority in the president uniquely to determine the use or non-use of nuclear weapons. We think that that's not the scenario that poses the most risk today. The most risk today is probably that which could be associated with a miscalculation, a mistake, a blunder.
Back in a few minutes with more of my conversation with former U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now let's get back to my conversation with former U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz. Moniz was in Iowa recently. He now heads the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a nonpartisan focused on preventing catastrophic attacks and accidents with weapons of mass destruction. At this point in our discussion, I asked Moniz about the most likely scenario for a nuclear weapon to be used today.
The risk comes particularly because the president of the United States and the president of Russia, for that matter, if they were to receive incorrect information for either reason about an incoming attack, they at best have, say, 10 minutes to decide. And I would argue that it's probably shorter than that. We should be working now in this post-Cold War period, and it's particularly important with Russia because of the simple fact that they and we together have more than 90% of the world's nuclear weapons. We should be working to increase that time. It would make an enormous difference if the president had, instead of 10 minutes, had 20 minutes or 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we believe the two presidents should order their militaries to get together and figure out ways to have confidence that there is more time for a response that would allow one to clarify the situation in terms of attack or false information. That's just one example. So there's a lot to do, and we believe there are a bunch of steps right now. Another step I'll mention that again comes into the political arena is that during the Cold War, as these issues were considered to be a major responsibility, an ongoing responsibility of both the administration and the congressional branch, there was always a significant core of members that caucused on these issues, if you like, and were very educated and aware. And if there were a crisis, they were members who could be quickly consulted, for example. There was also, by the way, in the 1980s, a joint congressional administration oversight group in terms of the arms control activities. That doesn't exist today. And there's a case where the leadership in both houses of Congress, both majority and minority, need to have chairman and ranking members of the key committees should really have ongoing briefings in terms of the situation on the ground, issue of where the risks are, perhaps going through scenarios with red teams. How would one respond to different kinds of situations? Mm-hmm. How can the Congress and the administration work together to provide the political space for the ongoing professional dialogues that we need? So there's a lot that could be done right now, which doesn't require, you know, major changes of authorities, doesn't require major new legislation. A lot of it is awareness and having leadership aware of what would be the response when a potential crisis arose.
Secretary Moniz, let me ask you about the other aspects of threat that your organization, the Nuclear Threat Initiative, covers in terms of mass destruction and disruption, biological and chemical. You haven't gone into those. How big of a threat are either of those currently?
Well, right now, we are putting a major effort into building our capabilities in terms of biological threat in particular. I don't want to dismiss chemical threats, but right now, in terms of what we as a globally facing but non-governmental organization can do, we see that the emerging threats in the biological sphere is an important area of focus. Let me explain why. Why would an organization like ours be significantly increasing our effort? Clearly, we have seen in the last years, things like the Ebola crises, which are obviously coming out of the natural world, and managing the pandemic possibilities are very, very challenging. However, in addition, what we are seeing is with the advances in synthetic biology, gene editing, and the like, there is the potential for engineering bad organisms that can lead to pandemics. Now, the responses may be very similar in many ways in terms of preventing the spread of the disease. However, in the case of an engineered organism, there is the additional concern that the engineering might be in a way to prevent the treatments we have from being effective, for example. Another thing is it would require then the humanitarian and public health responders to be working in parallel with national security or security forces, because it would be very important, of course, to understand the origins, to be able to make sure that there's not a repeat. So many new dimensions come in with the possible misuse of some of these new biological techniques, and that really is the starting point for our work in this. We've been effective, I think, in, for example, becoming an organization that brings together these public health and security communities together, so that they can be prepared in the event of such an event. And I want to say that this is not just science fiction. For example, in 2018, there was published a paper. I personally, at least, kind of regret that it was published, but it was published, where an academic group noted that it had, from scratch, and not with a lot of money, about $100,000, synthesized from scratch what's called the horsepox virus. The horsepox virus is not one that puts humans at risk directly. However, it is very, very similar to smallpox. And so it just shows, it was a vivid demonstration that one could, for example, have groups synthesizing a smallpox virus for the purpose of having a biological weapon. So that's what the risks are. Mm-hmm. And what we are trying to do is first, we published, and I would invite the listeners to go to the Nuclear Threat Initiative website. I think they would be interested to see an index that we published just about a month ago that went through 195 countries individually to look at their preparedness for managing a pandemic. By the way, I'm happy to say that while far from perfect, the United States did come out very well in that ranking, but overall, the performance, the evaluation was one where we could see very, very clearly there are many, many gaps to be addressed in just about every country to be prepared for that kind of public health crisis. Secondly, we are working actively with international groups, including, for example, the World Economic Forum, that has very, very strong connections to the private sector worldwide, trying to get norms in place for how researchers, for example, work in this area of gene editing to avoid the risks that we discussed earlier. So this gives you a flavor, I hope, of the kinds of things that we are very active in addressing, and have global attention, if you like, in terms of raising these issues and putting forward at least some first steps to minimize the risks.
Do we know, Secretary Moniz, of bad actors out there right now who are perhaps engineering organisms to be destructive on a mass scale? Are there actors, countries that we have our eye on for that particular reason?
Well, of course, we do know that historically there were lots of biological weapons developed in many countries. The Biological Weapons Convention has helped roll that back. But I would, without getting into specifics, I'd have to say that we are not convinced that the world is free of this threat. And as I say, it's only amplified by the rapid developments in the science and technology in these last years. Mm-hmm. And that paper I mentioned shows that the capability is there, and in a certain sense, at least in that one case, even something of a recipe for moving forward.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could expand on briefly what you mentioned earlier, the development of AI. It's in all of our lives now, down to our smart speakers and so forth, but you talked about it in the context of decision making, in trying to identify attacks on our country. How is AI, you would think that AI would make it easier, quicker to identify attacks with human counterparts working together with AI, but you seem to indicate that that it poses perhaps a greater threat.
Well, first of all, I think you put your finger right on it, that AI as a technology to assist human decision-making can be a tremendous benefit. However, in the situation I mentioned earlier, in terms of the nuclear weapons risks and the very, very short time of making decisions is leading to increasing reliance on artificial intelligence, which of course can get to decisions extremely quickly. The risk is, in our view, is if that becomes the decision-making process, the fidelity of the decisions made in AI or machine learning depends critically on how those systems are trained based upon authenticated data, et cetera. Well, the question is, do we really want to leave life and death decisions, quite literally, not life and death decisions for individuals, but even for societies, do we really want to leave those outside the chain of decision making of human beings who can take into account a lot of factors, even if more slowly than a large computer? So those are the kinds of things. Again, we're not trying to say that we are living in that world today, but our job, I think, is to raise these issues so that the systems can evolve in a way that minimize risks.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if I can ask you about something that perhaps it falls outside of the Nuclear Threat Initiative sort of sphere. I understand you are working to build a congressional support for a major initiative designed to bring down the cost of carbon dioxide removal technologies over a decade or so. I wonder if you can talk about that. And of course, this all has to do with global warming. Mitigating measures alone are not sufficient to reach a net zero global carbon emissions by the time we need to.
Well, first of all, that certainly is outside of the Nuclear Threat Initiative sphere. I will say that I do also head a second organization called the Energy Futures Initiative, which in fact produced the report that that you mentioned. Yes. Yeah, so the point is that, you know, the Paris meeting in late 2015 is it's going on 4 years ago, and since then, the science has consistently been pushing us to more and more stringent targets for carbon mitigation, carbon removal, or at least the slowing down of the increase of carbon concentrations in the atmosphere. In Paris, the broad goal for mid-century was like 80% reduction, certainly for the industrialized countries. Now we're talking much more about net zero as being the target. Well, if we talk net zero, it's almost by definition saying that we will need at scale some negative carbon technologies, because the idea of mitigating all the way to zero is, to put it mildly, quite challenging. And I say that because, well, look, one thing we'll say right here in the state of Iowa, it's clear the agricultural sector is one that is extremely challenging to decarbon. I say carbon, but I mean any greenhouse gas. To remove the greenhouse gas emissions entirely would be extremely challenging. Mm-hmm. Well, so now we come to these ideas of carbon dioxide removal, let's say directly from the atmosphere. And I want to emphasize that we say that there are three different buckets, if you like, of technologies. One is natural processes. An example of that would be simply, you know, planting a lot more trees. Mm-hmm. would help. Then there are what you might call the pure technological processes, like directly capturing the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. We know how to do that. By the way, we do it all the time.
What, just sort of sucking down the air and processing it?
Yeah, because think about being in a submarine for many, many months. You have to take the CO2 out of the air there to keep it at the right balance for humans. Deep space flights. So we know that we can take CO2 out of the air. The trouble is, how do we get that done at very large scale and at a more affordable cost? So that's a second kind of general direction. And the third direction, which is also very important, is technology-enhanced natural processes. So, for example, the development of plants with extraordinarily deep root systems would take more CO2 out of the atmosphere, accelerating how minerals take CO2 out of the atmosphere. Those would be examples. So our report looked at 27 different portfolio elements, and we feel that this is absolutely going to be a critical technology, generally speaking. I mean, the whole portfolio of technologies will be absolutely essential, certainly to meet anything like a net zero target by mid-century. We say that, of course, to get there, we need to start a major research and development and demonstration program now. We estimate about roughly a $10 billion program over 10 years. A billion a year, by the way, is, you know, it's a lot of money, but it's not in any way out of sync with a number of other major programs that we exercise. And so we think this is a very, very high priority. And I'm pleased to say that we have been talking a lot with members of Congress, both parties, both chambers, and there's a lot of interest now in pursuing this. Obviously, the devil's in the details, but I think this innovation agenda is one that attracts bipartisan support.
Okay, that was a key question because I wanted to jump in there about the political support here, given the current atmosphere, given an administration, a leader who calls climate change a hoax, a Chinese hoax. How hopeful can you be that together all of these, this menu of fixes for our carbon problem on this planet, how hopeful are you that we will avert a catastrophe in time?
Well, I'm very hopeful that we will be picking up the pace dramatically, certainly on this innovation agenda, which, as I say, is certainly the place where there is lots of bipartisan support. I believe there is also growing bipartisan support for taking policy measures that will accelerate the clean energy transition. There is clearly, can't be Pollyannish, there is clearly far less agreement on what those policy measures are than in the innovation agenda. But I think it's coming, and I think we're going to reach a tipping point, mainly because citizens all over the country are seeing, frankly, the effects of climate change. I think there's the realization is growing that that this is not only an issue for our children and grandchildren, as much as we love them, but it's also an issue today, and that we are paying a big price in agriculture, in coastal cities, in look at the situation in California with the fires. Who could have imagined that in a place like California, you would have the utility turning off power to people for, you know, days and days at a time? And so people are realizing that these effects are hurting us dramatically now, and I think that ultimately is what is going to be leading us to much more accelerated action to address greenhouse gas emissions. However, you phrase the question as avoiding, I won't say it exactly as you did, but avoiding the significant impacts of going to beyond 1.5, beyond 2 degrees. And I have to say that there, I don't give up. We have to keep fighting and fighting for every tenth of a degree. But I have to admit, it's a global challenge. We'll need the industrialized countries like the United States to take the lead, but we're also going to have to bring along all those emerging economies, all those developing countries, and that's going to be harder. So, I can't sit here with total confidence and say we're going to be able to meet the 2-degree target or the 1.5-degree target, but I'm not going to give up either on it. And I certainly believe that the science and technology innovation will play a major, major role in this, as will the kind of business model innovation that we are seeing as well.
Well, Secretary Moniz, I want to tell you it's been such a pleasure to have you step into our studio to have this discussion, taking the opportunity to talk with us while you're in Iowa working with the State Public Policy Group, also speaking before the Greater Des Moines Committee on Foreign Relations. We appreciate it very much, and thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Matt Alvarez, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Listen to any of our shows as a podcast, available at iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.